Bitcoin price. Prices are set at margin. There's always demand for Bitcoin. The question is, what is the price?
So that's where the Bitcoin price comes from.
David Lawant is head of research at Anchorage Digital and one of the sharper voices on institutional Bitcoin and crypto market structure.
His background spans traditional finance, crypto trading desks, and digital asset research across firms like FalconX and Bitwise.
When you have a lot of trading activity and a narrowing order book, this is probably a signal that the market regime is about to change. So these things have a lot of predictive potential. Without the support from US domestic flows, price action movements have not been very sustainable.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today I'm joined by David Lawant. It's great to have you here, David.
Hey, Pascal, thank you so much. It's great to be here. This has been a long time coming. We've been chatting for a while, right, to be here in this conversation, and I'm excited for it.
Yeah, it's great that we finally made it. That's usually how it goes. You go back and forth. You need to find a day. There's a time zone difference and everything involved nowadays. So, but we made it. So it's cool to have you here. Maybe it would be great if you could quickly introduce yourself so all the listeners know where you're coming from, what you do.
Yeah, of course. My name is David Lawant. I'm head of research at Anchorage Digital. We can go deeper into what Anchorage does. Maybe we can spend a little bit more time on institutional crypto market infrastructure. And Anchorage is one of the key players there. But I'm head of research at Anchorage. I joined the firm relatively recently, just 3 months ago. Before that, I was head of research at FalconX, which is one of the leading crypto trading desks too. I was there for about 3 years. Before that, I was head of research at Bitwise Asset Management, one of the crypto index providers, Bitcoin spot ETF issuer. It was one of the earlier employees there. And before that, I used to work in TradFi. I used to be a sell-side equities analyst. I used to be one of those guys who do those complicated DCFs and issue reports talking about investment recommendations. I used to cover Latin America. That's where I'm originally from. I've been working for large global banks. So that's basically it. TradFi guy, fell in the Bitcoin rabbit hole, and now I'm a crypto guy. I spent so my time on like prime brokerage and trading desks. So yeah, that's what.
Yeah. When did you cross the Rubicon from TradFi to crypto? Because it feels like you've worked for many crypto firms already. So it must have been quite some time ago, I guess. Yeah.
It was about 7 years ago. So it's been quite a journey for sure. It's, you know, Bitcoin has been growing in me very slowly. I used to be a gold bug when I used to work in traditional markets, but a lot of these things you could not discuss openly at the time. I was a big fan of gold, and I learned about Bitcoin probably in 2015 or so, but I had the kind of bitter shift reaction to it. I was like, there's no way this thing can replace gold. And it took me a couple of years for me to be convinced that Bitcoin is actually a viable alternative to gold. And I would say today, maybe it's our only hope to restore some money, you know? So yeah, that's basically where I started and have been evolving from there.
What made the penny drop for you? Because I feel like a lot of people are still coming, are not coming around because they don't see the use case or the value. So what made the penny drop for you then?
You mean for Bitcoin as this substitute? Man, I'm not sure if I can point to something specific. But definitely for me, a determining factor has been a lot of work that was done trying to bridge Austrian economics and Bitcoin. Probably in the 2010 era, I wasn't there at the time. I was kind of late to it. But a bunch of folks, like some of the earlier kind of Austrian economist who started to spend time on Bitcoin. There was a guy called Konrad Graf for folks who are familiar, the Nakamoto Institute guy. So I started to follow these folks and started, that's when it started to grow on me a lot more.
Oh, okay. So you're familiar with Austrian economics then, I guess.
I am. I'm actually a big fan. Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. I just remember because like when I was in Brazil, you know, there were all these stickers, Menos Marx, Mais Mises, which I very liked, you know, and so I guess you must be familiar with them as well then.
For sure. The Mises Institute in Brazil is massive.
Yeah.
I think it's probably one of the most successful across the globe. So yeah. It's really
cool.
Great.
That was also my sort of upbringing. And then my journey into Bitcoin was really Austrian economics. And then it's kind of funny for me. It was also, first it was Austrian economics. And then I only learned about Bitcoin. For many people, it's the other way around. They hear about Bitcoin and they get into Austrian economics. But yeah, so it feels like I'm talking to one of the Austrian economics OGs here as well. That's cool.
Awesome. I have this. Travelers. That's good.
Yeah.
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 From Austrian economics to Bitcoin, it's usually the other way around, as you well put.
Yeah, yes. So I'd like to start with one question that I get a lot, not from Austrian economists, but like from people who are looking at Bitcoin and they're like asking, where does Bitcoin's price come from in the first place? You know, and my usual answer is like, yeah, it's supply and demand, you know, but then given you've worked with all these companies, you know, I think prime brokerages as well and research, but then I guess you are fit to answer this question. Where does the Bitcoin price come from? How does it form? I guess it's a huge question, but maybe we can start there.
That's a huge question. That thing gets it into a very deep rabbit hole. But maybe I will start with, first, there's no one Bitcoin price, right? It's not like a stock or, I don't know, certain assets that might change only, might trade in only one specific place. Bitcoin trades in many different places. But there's actually any given point in time, there's actually many Bitcoin prices, right? You're going to have an exchange in Switzerland quoting BTC and Swiss francs. Here in the US, there's a bunch of exchanges quoting Bitcoin in US dollars, but the same in Brazil. Of course, there's a few markets that lead others, other markets that are more lagging. And there is a big today and sophisticated market infrastructure that kind of puts all these prices more or less in sync. But the first thing I would say is that there's not one single Bitcoin price. And this is just talking about the spot market, right? This is like ready Bitcoin for ready spot. Today, again, the Bitcoin market is much more sophisticated than that. You have futures markets. You have perpetual futures markets, the popular perps. You have ETFs, which also trade as a Bitcoin proxy and have been consistently growing as a percentage of how much Bitcoin trades in a day, for example. You can even look into things like MicroStrategy, right, as a stock that is also kind of a levered Bitcoin proxy, not as pure as these other things that I mentioned, but there's many, many, many ways that the Bitcoin price can move. Oh, and I forgot to mention the options market, which is a huge one and one that has been growing a lot over the past few years. So the first thing I would say is that there's no one Bitcoin price, and prices always need to be seen within a context, right? How much liquidity is driving that price? Where is that kind of price formation process coming from? So yeah, there's a lot to it. But let's just abstract to the idea of this single Bitcoin price, the one we see on the screen at CoinGecko or CoinMarketCap. And as you said, I think every economist, I would say, whether you're Austrian or monetarist or Keynesian, maybe not the Marxist ones. Those guys are still in the labor theory of value age. But let's say every modern economist would agree that prices are set at the margin, right? The concept of marginal utility and prices being set by supply and demand at the margin is pretty well established within pretty much any sort of economic school. So that's where the Bitcoin price comes from. I mean, you usually have a bunch of folks who want to buy Bitcoin. You have a bunch of folks who want to sell Bitcoin. The folks who want to buy Bitcoin, if you look, like for me, like from a trading desk perspective, we're always paying attention to what we call the order book looks like. So at any point in time, you can aggregate all these exchanges in the world, at least aggregate a big chunk of these exchanges in the world, you're going to see a bunch of people saying, hey, I want to buy Bitcoin, this much Bitcoin at this price, this much Bitcoin at this price, and this much Bitcoin at that price. And also on the other side, there's a bunch of folks saying, I want to sell this much Bitcoin at this price. I want to sell that much Bitcoin at that price, and so on and so forth. So you kind of build an order book, and you basically can know how much Bitcoin is for sale at any point in time at a determined price. Whenever these things cross, whenever somebody wants to buy at an ask price, or whenever somebody wants to sell at a bid price, a trade happens, and that's the price that you see on the screen.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes. Interesting. Yeah. And coming back to what you told us about, like, there's not only one price. I mean, in the end, exactly, this is the kind of case because we have all these different exchanges. But then there's still sort of this global price, which is sort of the same, I would say, but it's not, you know. And this is probably because of the arbitrage people that are out there who keep these prices in check, right? And so what are the market players that are usually doing this type of arbitrage to make sure that even though we have all these different prices, they don't deviate from one another too much? What are the market players that are involved there? Is it market makers? Is it prime brokers? Like, how do we make sense of all these different players in the market, so to say?
Yeah, 100%. There's a big ecosystem of market makers, Delta Neutral Fund. Delta Neutral are these guys who are just buying in one place and then selling another, kind of capturing a clip. They don't care that much whether the price is going up or down. They just care about how much of the clip that they're collecting. So there's a bunch of Delta Neutral players in the market. I think it's kind of an underestimated part of the market. If you look at Bitcoin's like trading volume, it's impossible to know how much is Delta Neutral, but I would guess that a big chunk of it is, like, maybe as much as half of it is Delta Neutral, just because Bitcoin trades in so many markets and there's so many folks trying to make all these prices in sync, and they're incentivized by the price differences. But yeah, to your point, there's a big chunk of market makers. There's a bunch of investment funds that they're just Delta Neutral. So basically, that's all they do. They can arb across exchanges. They can try to collect some sort of futures or derivatives premium. There's this thing called statistical arbitrage, which is a little less, like, taking a little bit more price risk. So there's a bunch of strategies that a lot of these funds do. They're usually quant heavy, systematic, kind of high frequency, or at least, yeah, kind of high frequency traders. So that's a big chunk of the market. Trading desks also can do that every once in a while. But yeah, 100%. There's a big part of the market that is kind of making all these prices in sync. This wasn't the case 10 years ago. Like 10 years ago, you would see sometimes the price of Bitcoin in Brazil, for example, trade at a 20% premium to the Bitcoin price in the US. Today, these divergences are very rare, but it wasn't that long ago where you could see some massive spreads.
Yeah, there was also this term, the Kimchi premium, I think, where it kind of signified that the prices in Korea were always 10 or 15% above like global prices, and people tried to arbitrage these prices away. So I guess this is somewhat still around because of regulatory reasons. But then, as you indicated, in most areas nowadays, arbitrage, yeah, is quite efficient. And in that sense, you don't have these price divergences anymore to that great extent, right? Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, interesting. And maybe one more question, given I have the expert here in front of me. You know, like, you hear this quite a lot, like spot is driving future is driving the spot price, like, you know, in different market environments, what is driving what? Is it the dog wagging its tail, or the tail wagging the dog, or whatever, you know? It's like, how would you answer this question to a layman who kind of thinks, okay, what is driving what, you know, and maybe in what environment is it spot that's more dominant and then futures, or is it even a fair question to ask in the first place, you know?
No, this is a great question to ask. Like, I work at a trading desk, right? So at a trading desk within a crypto infrastructure provider, institutional provider firm. And we can talk maybe a little bit more about that and what these guys actually do on a day-to-day basis. I feel like it's a somewhat sometimes opaque or elusive term, the prime brokers and the trading desks and the OTC desks and the market makers. But yeah, this is a big part of the Bitcoin and crypto institutional market. Definitely, sometimes the market is spot-led. Sometimes the market is futures-led. And within futures, sometimes that is happening in the perpetual future side, which is usually the case. That's the biggest market for Bitcoin in aggregate. But there's also actually one massive player in the non-perpetual futures, let's call them the dated futures complex, which is the CME. And the CME until recently was the biggest venue for Bitcoin open interest. That varies a lot over time. A rule of thumb that I usually use is that usually spot drives futures. In the spot market, you have a lot more directional price action. In the futures market, you have a lot of basis traders, you have a lot of these kind of arbitrageurs, you also have a lot of market making activity. So the spot market is where I usually spend most of my time. But having that said, there's definitely moments when futures are driving a price action. That's especially true when you are in a market regime that is changing. So like, for example, if there's extra demand for leverage, then folks tend to go to the futures market. And these are times when futures perhaps can lead price action. Sometimes you can have certain idiosyncratic events like we actually had at the end of last year. For example, there was a big unwind of CME basis trades. So all these guys that were just buying the spot and selling the future, there was a big reversal of that trade. And that ends up impacting spot prices, depending on how aggressive and how fast these changes happen. So yeah, it actually kind of varies. And that's what makes it fun, I guess.
Yeah, that all makes it fun. Is it then sort of fair to say as well that during bear markets, it might be more spot dominant just because leverage and open interest have kind of washed out. And that's why spot is like taking this big role. And then as you said, like if there's a frenzy going on, everyone wants to speculate all the Bitcoin price, you know, we're closer to the top. That's where then open interest is as its max, at its all-time high. And that's maybe where the futures and the options market are more relevant in terms of driving the price. Is that a fair assessment, like high level speaking?
Yeah, I think that's a good general rule of thumb. Of course, things can change, and especially in Bitcoin and crypto, this is such a new market and the market structure is changing all the time. So for example, here an example I can give you, a recent one, is the October 10 crash, right? So after the October 10 crash, we saw volatility shrink. We saw demand for leverage shrink in the market. So despite whatever was happening to prices or the market cycle, demand for leverage was just vanished. And it actually didn't quite recover for, I would say, maybe up until today. So yeah, sometimes you have all these kind of market structure shifts that happen, but I think it's a fair assessment that you can almost look at things like the CME basis, right? So the difference between the CME price and the spot Bitcoin price as a little bit of a proxy for institutional demand for leverage. And you can look into that as a proxy for, let's say, should I call it speculative market kind of furor, right? Usually when you are close to like peak bull market territory, you're going to see the CME basis trade.
Thanks for explaining this. You mentioned another term that I want to come back to, and it's the order books, you know, and this is also something a lot of people maybe have a very vague understanding of. So if you could kind of tell us what an order book is in the first place, and then also how to read it in terms of to get maybe a better picture of liquidity and what's going on in markets, or what do you guys use the order book for when you look at it? Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So you can think of the order book as this central matching engine that like a lot of exchanges or a lot of the liquidity venues use to match buyers and sellers. That's not the only way to do it. There's also other markets. They're very large. There's what we call the bilateral market, the OTC market. There's no order book there. These are just two folks on the phone deciding on the price. This is where a lot of the very large trades happen. But you have a lot of liquidity that happens across exchanges. And exchanges have this order book, which is literally a book that says, well, now it's a digital ledger that says, you have this much demand for Bitcoin at this price and this much demand for Bitcoin at that price and so on. And the same for how much supply you have to sell Bitcoin at a certain price. So basically, think about this as a ledger that has quantity of Bitcoin and the price at which this Bitcoin could be either sold or bought. And there's a gap in the middle, right? There's a gap. So there, you have all these bids, they go up into a certain price. You have all these asks that they start at a certain price and they go up. Whenever these things, again, whenever someone wants to sell, they will sell at the bid or at the best bid, right? And then they will start consuming the order book from there. Whenever somebody wants to buy, they will buy at the lowest ask and they will also start to consume the order book up from there. So that's basically how the order book evolves. Each exchange has an order book. So Coinbase has an order book, Binance has an order book, OKX has an order book, Bybit has an order book, Kraken has an order book. So basically, one thing that a lot of folks do in order to have a better context on what's going on with the Bitcoin market is just to aggregate all these orders, all these buys and sells into one single consolidated market order book. You can do this for spot, you can do this for futures, you can do this for options. I think most folks spend time looking at the spot order book. As I said, most of the time, it's where a lot of the directional price action happens. So yeah, that's kind of the concept for me.
And that was very well explained. So if you kind of say, okay, you know, you can buy yourself into the order book and you consume the ask, and then also on the bid side, you can consume this. To me, this sounds like the more bids and asks you have, the deeper the order book, the more liquid the market, the less kind of price jumps around, you know, and that's probably true. Yeah. So is that something when you look at order books, you want to know, okay, how can prices move, or is the order book now thin? And that's why we kind of have to be kind of defensive, because price actually could not be real in that sense. Or what do you infer by looking at the order book as a prime broker or a trader?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, the order book is a very important concept. I would say, like, the first thing people look is at the price. What is the dollar price of Bitcoin? The second thing people look at is the volume, right? How much Bitcoin is trading, how much Bitcoin is exchanging hands. And then the third thing people look at is the order book. How, to your point, and I think you put it very nicely, how deep the order book is. So imagine that you have all these, let's say, sell orders at certain price points. Basically, you're going to say, let's say I'm a big player and I want to sell, let's say, $10 million of Bitcoin. And I can look into the order book and say, okay, if I put in sell $10 million of Bitcoin, how much will I move the price down? How much will I consume of the order book? Or the other way around, if I want to buy, let's say, $10 million of Bitcoin, how much of the ask part of the book will I consume? So that gives you kind of a little bit of a sense of your price impact, especially for large orders. This is not necessarily what folks do. That's why they use trading desks, right? That's what folks like we are here for. But yeah, there's a very strong focus on the depth of the market. And we can, again, aggregate all these exchanges, look at this order book, see how it evolves over time, see how it's skewed, whether to the buy side or to the sell side. And that's where I think you can get quite a few interesting, insights on what's going on around the market besides just the price.
Yes. So you just mentioned whether it's skewed to the sell or the bid side. Like, where do I get the information from? Like, or asked differently, what does it tell me if it flips from sell side to bid side or vice versa? Like, could you be more specific on that front as well?
Yeah, 100%. So perhaps before getting there, if you don't mind, maybe the first thing people look at is how narrow, how wide the order book gets, especially as it compares to volume activity. So I can give you a few examples. I have a few charts as well, if you're just curious in seeing how the Bitcoin order book looks like right now. I can share.
Yes, you can just share. That would be great.
Let me see. Yeah, so this is how the Bitcoin order book looks like in a few different dApps. And there's a few data idiosyncrasies here. We don't need to get too deep into how I wrangle the data, but there's a few nuances here. Because not all exchanges report the same kind of data. So basically, this is how I look at, for example, the Bitcoin order book. The first thing you're going to look into is how deep the market is. Usually, folks will look how deep the market is, both in native units, so in number of Bitcoin, and also in US dollars. I tend to focus more on the left chart here, which is the one in native units. You kind of exclude the price impact. But that's how more or less the Bitcoin spot order book looks like. Here you have different dApps. Again, this is the blue area here is the 0.1%. So within 0.1%, you would move, you can still like work with like 100 plus Bitcoin without moving the price by 0.1%. 0.2%, we're at the 200 Bitcoin level. And then 0.5%, we're around the 400 Bitcoin level. That's where we are right now. Important thing here is that these are kind of more theoretical analyses, because if you're selling 400 Bitcoin, you're probably not doing that straight on exchanges. You're talking to an OTC provider, you're calling a trading desk. It doesn't mean that you necessarily do this, but it kind of shows you how much natural demand there is in the spot market. There's a few data limitations here. We don't need to cover those. But that's kind of, I think, interesting. And it shows you how the market looks like. And then you can see certain things, like you can see how the order book got very narrow around and right after the October 10 crash. So like this is basically market makers pulling out of the market or widening their bids and asks because of market uncertainty. This is one signal that people pay attention to. They don't happen very often. The Bitcoin price is, the Bitcoin order book depth is actually impressively constant, given how much, or impressively flat, given how much the Bitcoin price moves, and given how much trading volumes moves, which is way more than the price. So there's a lot of volatility here, but the spot order book in Bitcoin native units doesn't change much. But whenever it changes, it usually means that something meaningful is happening. And that's one thing that folks use as an important market signal, like especially if you are pairing this together with trading volumes. The framework I use is that when you have a lot of trading activity and a narrowing order book, this is probably a signal that the market regime is about to change. And you could spot, you could not anticipate, but you could probably have an early confirmation signal in most of the big market direction changes just by looking at these two simple indicators. So again, big spot volumes, narrow order books. That's usually a signal that the market is anticipating some sort of uncertainty in the future and that the market regime either for the positive or for the negative. Right now, we're actually in the pretty opposite of that. Spot volumes are incredibly low, and the order book depth is actually relatively high, or at least it's more or less where it has ever been, which is a market of complacency. So this is the market where we are right now, just chopping, right? Let's say between 60 and 80K, maybe that's a good band to work with. That's what you can see. One thing that I would be looking for example, in order to be confident that we are getting away or we're getting out of this range, would be, again, increase in spot volumes and tighter order book depth. So far, none of these indicators are flashing. That's more or less where we are.
Interesting. Very interesting. And can I also now infer from this chart alone where the skew is at? Is it more skewed to the sell side or the ask side, a bit side? Yeah. How would I have to do this? Like,
so the other thing folks look is how skewed the order book is to the sell side or to the buy side. This indicator, I think, is an interesting one. It's going to be used sparingly, though. And this one has a little bit of leading indicator potential. And the idea of the order book getting too skewed to maybe the sell side or to the buy side is basically when you think about the market dynamics, right? So let me give you an example. Let's assume that the Bitcoin price is taking off and it's moving away from the 60K to the 80K level, right? So it's breaking out of that band. And we need to decide, is this a new trend or are we just going to chop around 8K and come back to the 65K, 67K level where we are right now? So that's where things like the order book skew makes interesting, because in this example, let's say the Bitcoin price starts to go up and you start to get excited about a potential uptrend. One thing you want to pay attention to is whether those sell orders, right? Imagine that when you are seeing the price going up, usually what's happening is that there's a lot of people buying and that sell part of the order book is kind of getting consumed. So the main thing, one thing, for example, you want to pay attention to is whether this sell pressure in the order book that is being consumed, whether there is any new sell potential coming from the market. So that's where this skew of the order book matters, right? If you start to see, let's say, the price going up, and then let's say, for example, that you see a lot of sell pressure coming, you can probably anticipate some of that just by looking at the order book starting to get skewed to the sell side. So these things have a lot of predictive potential. I'm actually a big fan of the order book skew type of indicators, but they will usually give you a sign for like the very short term, right? These things will usually realize and kind of exhaust themselves in a matter of hours or maybe days, not more than that. So this is usually a good kind of short-term leading indicator of changes in the kind of market trend from a short-term perspective. Again, what you're trying to measure, and a lot of the times you're looking at this from even, I would say, contrarian perspective, but basically what we're trying to measure is how much sell pressure or how much buy pressure is being consumed and how much new buy pressure or sell pressure is coming in new to the market. That's basically what the order book skew tells you. I don't have the indicator here in a chart, but yeah, I would definitely look at the order book skew as a separate indicator, because this charts can get very choppy. Usually you want to apply some sort of moving average to smooth out those trends, but yeah.
Okay, very fascinating. Yeah, I was just going to ask, because I felt like from looking at this indicator here and this chart alone, I think I cannot infer this skew. That's where you would have to get a more granular overview of an order book. But
yeah, I don't have the order book skew chart here with me. I can send it to you later, though, and then you'll spot some of these.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. Yeah, because now what you're telling me, because I heard people arguing and saying this, you know, that they can kind of tell from the spot order book whether a breakout is coming or not, you know, and I was always wondering, yeah, how can you kind of do this? But I think you just neatly explained, you know, by looking at this, that you can. It's probably not sure because there nothing is ever certain. But I mean, you get a sense of what is sort of brewing under the hood or boiling under the hood, you know. And so, that's very, very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. No market indicator is 100% correct. But some of them kind of help you get a better context of what's going on and maybe help make you a more informed view on what the market might be about to do. Some of them are leading indicators, like I think the order book skew is one of them. Others are more lagging indicators, but even those are helpful because sometimes if you can get an early signal that gives you a certain level of confidence in a certain market trend, those things can be helpful too. That's where things like just looking at trading volumes or where the order book is, whether it's narrow, whether it's wide, that's where these things fit, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so fascinating. And at the risk of jumping around here, I want to come back to another term that you mentioned a while back, you know, and it was the OTC desks, you know. But when I heard this question just came to my mind, because I want to ask it to like a pro like you.
In Bitcoin, you often hear people, especially on X, you know, they share these screenshots of, oh, the order books or sort of the OTC desks are emptying out. There are only 30 Bitcoins left in the OTC desk. And that's why what they kind of try to tell you is, okay, Bitcoin is so scarce, you know, the price will have to explode. I have a feeling of, I mean, I'm not really an expert on this, but I have a feeling this is kind of just empty talk, you know. And could you kind of give us sort of an indication, is there ever a day where sort of an OTC desk could run out of Bitcoin? Or, yeah, how do you think about these type of things?
The way I think about it is there's always demand for Bitcoin. The question is, what is the price? I don't think that a lot of these scenarios, the OTC desks are running out of Bitcoin, and then we're going to have this massive supply shock to the upside. I don't think a lot of these kind of talks are correct. The way you think about the, let's say, institutional market structure, and I always like to draw a comparison from a typical retail flow, right? So let's say maybe you or maybe me, if we want to buy a fraction of a Bitcoin, or even if we want to buy a whole Bitcoin, the flow that we're going to go through is very different from the flow that, let's say, a big ETF issuer or a big hedge fund will go through if they want to buy usually a much larger amount of Bitcoin. And I think it's important to draw this comparison just for us to maybe start the conversation here. If we want to buy, let's say, a fraction of a Bitcoin, you or me, basically what we're going to do is we're going to open an account at an exchange. We're going to wire fiat from our bank accounts to that exchange. That might take a while. Maybe now these cycles are getting faster as crypto and the payments infrastructure is getting more integrated, but usually there's a lag to it and it takes a while to settle. And then once our fiat is showing up as a balance in our exchange, we're gonna buy our Bitcoin, right? We can put in a market order or a limit order, depending how sophisticated you are. You're just gonna get your Bitcoin. It's going to sit on that exchange, and then maybe you're going to decide to do something with it. Maybe you're going to take it into self-custody. Maybe you're going to do something else with it. And that's where I think for our interest here, that's where the cycle ends. The institutional folks are very different. Imagine you are a big ETF issuer, and you need to buy, let's say, a large amount, let's say $100 million of Bitcoin because you had massive inflows in your ETF on that day. So what the flow that these guys need to go through is actually very different. These guys are obviously they don't have accounts at a lot of these specific exchanges. They're wiring money, they're spending, they're waiting for the wire to settle, and then they're buying the Bitcoin. What they're doing is they're using these liquidity providers. So these are, for example, OTC desks. These are, for example, prime brokers, where they're just going to quote them. And for example, in the ETF case, they usually have a price that is set up at a time. And they say, hey, I need to buy this amount of Bitcoin, usually a large amount, or sell at this certain index that will settle at a certain time. What price can you give me compared to that index? So they're going to quote a bunch of desks. And then these guys will give them their best shots, and then they will decide what they're going to do with it. That's, for example, like a very simplified version of how like an ETF Bitcoin purchase process would look like. It can get very sophisticated. There's in-kind versus cash creations and redemptions. But that's more, this is just to illustrate that these guys, they rely on folks like us to first aggregate a lot of the liquidity. Number two, sometimes we provide our own balance sheet and we provide kind of credit for them. Is a lot of these trades, they're not done on a pre-funded basis. They just do the trade, we deliver the Bitcoin, and then we get paid. Of course, there's a little bit of a credit spread involved here, but there's a lot of there's much bigger requirements and execution requirements when you're an institutional player. And the second thing is, because of the size of the trades, you can just not throw them in the market as we probably can. Right. I don't know about you, but my size is definitely not big enough to move the Bitcoin market.
Yeah.
Honestly,
my size is not size either. So,
size. Yeah. But for a lot of these guys, again, if you're a big hedge fund or a big ETF issuer or a big venture capital fund, and then you're making these big bets, then you probably want to be very careful about how you place these trades. Sometimes you see an accident actually here or there, right? Sometimes you see a fat finger and then price collapse in an exchange and then come back. So these are the things you got to be careful about. And that's why this whole infrastructure exists. So there's basically market makers. Market makers are buying and selling all the time. And they're doing this on a recurring basis and constant basis that on average, they will try to make money. So they're always, you always have a buy and a sell order on the book. And basically they want to get hit on their buy order and they want to get hit on their sell order and they will capture whatever the spread here is over time. So that's more or less what market makers do. OTC desks, they're basically focused on these like big trades. They provide liquidity. A lot of them carry inventory. A lot of them sit on a bunch of Bitcoin and they can buy or sell and manage their inventory accordingly. And then prime brokers, they basically add another suite of services on top of all of that. For at Anchorage, we do prime services, which means we have a spot desk where we do, let's say, Bitcoin spot trading, but we also have a very active options desk, right? So actually, we're very active on the options side of things. And number three, this is where a lot of the prime brokerage concept comes from, or originally comes from. So we have a lending desk. Also an aspect of credit provisioning, all these things that I mentioned. Sometimes it's a one-day delay, delayed settlement. Sometimes it's a more sophisticated credit structure. So this is how basically these guys operate. And you can think of them as this key infrastructure that people use in order to engage with the market. I would say today they're pretty much necessary, given how the Bitcoin market structure got more sophisticated, given the size of the players that are getting involved. So you have a number of companies. It's not a huge number, but it's a decent number. And it's a very competitive market that are going for this more institutional market.
Yeah, so interesting. Thanks for explaining this. Listening to you, I feel like there is some truth to this statement that I usually hear, you know, that like if you are an institutional player and you have a bunch of Bitcoin, you are a whale or whatever, you're servicing a whale, then you want to go through an OTC desk so to not move the price in that extent. And I remember, you know, in 2024, I think it was in summer when the German government kind of, when everyone panicked over these Bitcoin, the 50,000 BTC that were sold, some of them said, well, it looks like they sold on an exchange because like you have all this, the price moving so fast. And so, yeah, can you maybe summarize again, it's sort of true that if you go through OTC desk, you don't want the price to move that to the extent that on an exchange, but then there must be a connection. It has to feed through, you know, you can't just always go through OTC desk and then it will never kind of have an impact on price, you know? So like, where is the connection there?
100%. Like, the way to think about it is institutions will go to a liquidity provider to maximize their execution, which means to minimize their price impact. Having that said, there's only so much a liquidity provider can do, right? So let's say if a big player comes and say, hey, I want to sell this massive amount of Bitcoin. Let's just think about a hypothetical case here. Let someone calls my spot desk and say, I want to sell $1 billion of Bitcoin. And this is a big amount. It's not a huge amount because Bitcoin is a very liquid asset. So this is something you can do, but it's something that you have to do within a certain period of time. So let's just say that our trader is looking at a market and he says, given the current market conditions, I think you can probably execute this trade in 24 hours, whatever it is. And then you will kind of do a, like, let's say a TWAP, a time weighted average price over the next 24 hours. And we think that the market can absorb that. Just as a hypothetical example, assume the client says, no, I want to sell it in 10 minutes. Then there's only so much the desk can do. You know, of course, you have a bunch of hedging capabilities and there's the perps markets. There's a lot of things you can do and try to hedge. So today, these markets can sustain a pretty heavy amount of sell pressure without moving too much one way or another. But yeah, of course, there's a limit to how much you can do. So even if you're using a trading desk, at some point, the counterparty, the final counterparty, the one who's actually doing the sale, will usually define some of the terms of how they want to sell. And then the job of the liquidity provider is to do the best job possible and come up with the minimal market impact given those circumstances they're working under.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, in the end, yeah, you're somewhere you touch the market in that sense, and there's going to be a seller, and he's only going to sell based on these conditions. And in that sense, it feeds through to the current market price again, because that seller is probably not going to deviate that much from the current market price. Maybe you have some sophisticated sort of contracts and stuff figured out as a liquidity provider, and then you get some margin that you can squeeze out. But you're right. I mean, it's not possible. They don't have magic hands in that sense, you know, so that they're bound to the market as well.
Yes.
Yeah. I know you have some other charts prepared. Maybe you want to take us through these charts as well.
Sure. Yeah. I have a few of them here. I think they can be good just to give an example of how we think about like the liquidity trends and how the market can evolve.
Yeah.
Let me share my screen again. I can go through, yeah, just a couple of them. We don't need to go through all of them. We can skip this one, but this is basically just correlations between Bitcoin and the other traditional asset classes. These things are just interesting to see. And here you have Bitcoin versus the broad equity averages, the NASDAQ, the Russell 2000, and the S&P 500. These are correlations on a 90-day rolling basis. And then gold and silver. This is just for like macro context. Not something that is too sophisticated that we would pay attention to. These are the volumes charts that I was mentioning. So these are 7-day moving average charts of the spot market on the left, futures markets on the right, and you basically have BTC in purple. You have ETH in kind of teal, and you have SOL in this kind of orange color. And here, this is a long-term chart. This chart starts at the beginning of 2020. So it's been going on a long time. And you can see that right now we are actually at a pretty low stage. So volumes today, Bitcoin has been averaging a little over $5 to $6 billion a day, which is very low. Just for comparison, during like the peak of the cycle, end of 2024, when everybody was getting excited about the change in administration and the Bitcoin price was either breaking or about to break new all-time highs, we would regularly see Bitcoin trading at like $20, $25 billion a day. The top days would be like $45 billion. Now we're at 5 to 6. So this is just to give you a sense of how low liquidity is compared to where it was before. And here I'm focusing more on the spot side, which is the chart on the left.
But it looks like we are still a little bit above the 2022 bear market period, you know, at least from what I can tell. Not far above, but I feel like it's still some more volume going on, at least in Bitcoin for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely above. The thing I would argue, though, is that we should be way above the 2022 bear market, given how much more adoption we've had, right? There's the ETF market. The asset class today is much more, much better accepted across mainstream investors. So I think it should be way ahead. But yeah, we are. The one thing I would mention here, and this is an example of how these kind of liquidity trends change over time, is that, of course, in 2022, we didn't have Bitcoin spot ETFs. Now we do. And if I added the liquidity of Bitcoin spot ETFs here, this chart would look a little better. Not a lot better, but it would look significant. It would be like, I don't know, probably 30% higher or something like that. Mm. So a lot of the liquidity today that maybe in the past would live in the spot market, today might be living in the spot ETF market. This is a trend that gained a lot of steam, especially over the last 12 to 18 months, and it's still kind of going. And it's kind of interesting, right? Like 5 or 10 years ago, you didn't need to look into too many places to understand what's going on with the Bitcoin price action. There was just the Bitcoin spot market and there was a Bitcoin perps market. These were the two markets that really mattered. and maybe the CME at the time, which was growing. Today, you have, for example, the spot ETF market, which is massive and already within shooting distance of the Bitcoin spot market. You have the options market, which, as I mentioned in the beginning, is actually very large and getting more important. So the market structure is getting a little bit more complicated. These volume charts today, they need a little bit more nuance than before. But still, this number is very weak. I think in order to gain confidence that Bitcoin is shifting gears to maybe a more like bull market type territory, we would probably need to see these Bitcoin spot volumes to break above $10 billion or so mark per day.
Okay. But then, I mean, it's more that you're saying, okay, we're still in this bear market territory. This is undeniable, but it's not concerning in a sense of like that there's a real problem with the market in and of itself. You know, like when you compare it to 2022, when we're not far above it, you know, like it's not that you're like fundamentally concerned, you know, when you said like, oh, it should be way higher. Like, yeah.
No, I don't think so. This is a market that is defined by apathy. That this is basically what we are seeing. It's usually, in my view, a signal of a later stage bear market, or maybe the end of a bear market, or maybe even the beginning of the next bull market. But usually you have this apathy mood. You have like minor selling, minor capitulation, and things like that. This is usually like late bear market type of signals. And that's basically what we're seeing here. If we were on the verge of a big leg down, I would be looking at other markets. So for example, you can look quite a bit on the options markets to see what they're pricing in terms of near-term price action. None of these things are flashing. Actually, we just put out in a commentary today for our clients, if you look into the options market, what you're going to see is that there's a lot of caution in the short term, but there doesn't seem to be any market break priced in the medium to long term. But that's an example of a place I would look at for those types of signals. But right now, it's kind of a choppy market. It's not a signal of anything breaking either to the upside or to the downside.
You also have a chart on Coinbase Premium, right? Is that right? Because that's something which is recited quite often as well. And again, maybe if you could fill us in, what is this for? What is it telling us?
100%. It's also kind of all these liquidity trends. It's kind of a moving story because it depends on what the Coinbase Premium actually means. But the Coinbase Premium is basically the difference of the Bitcoin price at Coinbase versus the price of Bitcoin at Binance. There's a few adjustments you need to do, like dollar to tether, like prices. I like to look them on a Z-score basis, which is like how far they are from their like standard. So that's how I look at it. But it's usually a good indication of which flows are leading. You can use Coinbase as a proxy of U.S. domestic flows. You can use Binance as this offshore, maybe broader market flows. And the trend here has been actually pretty negative for the Coinbase Premium. This is also a long-term chart. It goes like 3 or 4 years back, actually almost 5 years back. And you can see, if you look here in the right side of the chart, that the Coinbase Premium has been negative. It's been actually a Coinbase discount for basically the longest time on record. We had a few changes here to the upside, mostly in January and February, when I think Bitcoin, you can see it, and it's also kind of intuitive, right? January, February, Bitcoin was kind of rehearsing a little bit of a recovery. That's when we started to see the Coinbase Premium shift a little bit positive. But other than that, it's been negative, not only pretty much to the highest extent, but also for the longest time in a while, or maybe in all of its history. And the reason why folks pay attention to the Coinbase Premium is that because the U.S. market is becoming very central to the Bitcoin price action, the Coinbase Premium is usually seen as an indicator for sustainability of price movements. There is this perception today, and again, these things can change, but over the past couple of years, it has been the case that without the support from U.S. domestic flows, price action movements have not been very sustainable. So that's, for example, one thing that people pay attention to. We're not in that scenario, but if we were to see, let's say in that hypothetical scenario, the Bitcoin price breaking up above the 80K level, spot volumes going up, order books getting tighter. So everything's starting to point out to a potential break to the upside. Maybe the next thing you would look at is at the Coinbase premium, just to see if you have this domestic kind of flow support to this price movement that usually starts in offshore exchanges, but you need this US support. The support is mostly coming from retail or from other sources that can typically trade on an exchange like Coinbase. Sometimes it's ETF flows, sometimes it's DHTs. It depends a little bit, but I would say nowadays it's probably mostly US domestic retail flows. The other place where we could go, and I've been hinting at this throughout the episode, is the options market. The options market is very interesting because it allows you to look at a very specific sleeve. These are usually, let's say, pro traders or institutional traders. So this tends to be a more quote-unquote smart money part of the market. And because options are very interesting instruments that allow you to have a very specific view of the market, you can start to see some interesting things that you just cannot see in, for example, spot and futures markets. But that's a longer conversation. Maybe we can do that in the next episode.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Yes, great. Yeah, as you said, we're coming up on the hour here, so it makes sense to call it the quits. So David, thanks a lot for all these very valuable information. Maybe if you can just quickly share with the audience, where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah, of course. Let's go. This has been a blast. I hope we can do it again. So yeah, I'm with Anchorage Digital. You can go to anchorage.com. That's our website. Or you can go to @Anchorage on X. There's a lot of information there. My name is David Lawant. So my handle on X is DLawant, D-L-A-W-A-N-T. Sometimes I post some of these charts and usually commenting about market conditions.
Thank you, David. I don't want to keep you any longer. Thanks for doing this and enjoy the rest of the week and then the weekend, I guess. And thanks for doing this. We'll do it in the future again.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you. Bye, David.